The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We'll start our show off today with another one of our urbanite stories, one of the ones we told last month, but now we have the residents from the street itself to talk about their lives there. It'll be very interesting. Stay with us for that, and then we'll be talking with David Kirby, author of a book called Animal Factory, a frightening but real book. We'll come to all that in a minute, but let's get you home safe. Turn this over to WEAA Traffic, and we'll be right back.
Support for WEAA is provided by the 2010 Census. More information on the census is available at 2010census.gov.
Crash cleared northbound 95 at 395. The update brought to you by Centrum Silver. It is slow from the Beltway up to the scene. Outer loop heavy, Hartford Road to Providence Road, and from Providence Road to the Harrisburg Expressway. Looking at the brake lights there. Busy again from 795 to the Baltimore National Pike. On the inner loop, you're bunched up coming up from the west side, 95 to Liberty Road, also Park Heights to York Road. Philadelphia at Middle River, there's a crash. Also one on East Ridge at Timonium, and a couple on Pulaski Highway. There's one at the Beltway, the other one at Golden Ring Road. 50 eastbound at the Route 2 450 interchange. Watch out for the stalled car. Centrum Silver age-adjusted multivitamins have key antioxidants and other nutrients that help protect the health of your heart, eyes, and bones as you age. I'm Joanna Campbell with Baltimore Area Traffic.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are going to have a conversation today, one of our Urbanite Radio stories. Last month, we had a conversation with Joan Jacobson and others who wrote the article about an East Baltimore street, and they were trying to find a place in Baltimore that was actually integrated racially in terms of the residents who lived on the street, and had a conversation about this street in Highlandtown. Those of us old enough to remember, Highlandtown was not integrated unless you wanted to integrate white ethnic groups, and then you might call it integrated. Beyond that, it wasn't. After the conversation, after reading the article, we said to ourselves, you know, it would be really interesting to have some of the folks who live in that neighborhood just join us for a conversation. As a matter of fact, one of those people on our show today, Shanaisha Sauls, called in that day and joined the conversation on the air for a bit. She's here with her husband, Edward, and Shanaisha Sauls are with us. They live on East Baltimore Street, been there for 7 years. Edward is a special ed teacher at the Baltimore Academy.
Yes, sir.
Shanaisha teaches as an assistant professor of political science at American University. Good to have you both in our studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Adam Stab is with us. He's an artist who's lived in East Baltimore since he was a teenager.
And I moved into Baltimore Street when I was 14.
And now you live in the house that you grew up in.
Yep.
Right? And Edward Kowski is with us and has been an activist in that neighborhood in Patterson Park for a long time, at least as long as I've been on the air.
20 years.
Yeah. So he's co-founder of the Patterson Park Community Development Corporation and executive director of the Patterson Park Public Charter School. And, Ed, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Join us here at 410-319-8888. As you hear the conversation unfold, anything grabs you, just join us with your thoughts and ideas. I'd love to hear your stories, especially, let's say, your stories about crossing a color line into a neighborhood for the first time. White to black to white, or any other combination we have in America, which can be a multitude of combinations. And your stories about what that was like, whether it was welcoming, not welcoming. Is it opening? Did it open you, open people around you? Did it close things down? So give us a shout, 410-319-8888. Now, the article started out, I mean, one of the things that we talked about, I love the part, Edward Sauls, when you told your mother, you grew up in East Baltimore, right?
Yes.
On
2732 East Preston Street.
Okay. In the heart of East Baltimore, on Preston Street. So, and you told your mother that you were moving into a house on Baltimore Street. Tell the story.
My mother's still not crazy about the location in which I choose to live. I try to sell it to her. I understand the value of where I live now. But all my mother can really recollect is her experience as a youth. And I actually share her experience through her stories. I remember living on 2732 East Preston Street, saying, "Mom, we're going to Patterson Park Pool." And this is the 80s. This is 1987.
So by that time, this, obviously, the pool was officially integrated anyway.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. But the warning that was given was, that's not our part of town. If someone starts to chase you, you better run because they're going to outnumber you. And she went to Patterson. So I knew that was in that part of town, and she probably knew what she was talking about. But I can't say that I ever had an issue. We kind of knew to, you know, go to the pool and come back home. We didn't hang out. We didn't venture. But I actually went to what is now Patterson Park Charter School. I went to St. Elizabeth in the early 80s. And I was one of three black kids in my first grade class. So, I mean, I was used to, I knew what to expect in that part of town. When I moved in 02, I really didn't know how the community had grown. And it's actually grown around us. The community that I live in today is very affluent, but if you go one block to the west, it's even more affluent. If you go one block to the east, it's less affluent.
Right.
You go south, you're in Canton. You know, that's the promised land. You know? Yeah, but if you travel, obviously, north, it gets a little rocky for some. But it's not an accident. I mean, the way I see it, a border was chosen. Okay, we're going to try to revitalize a community. It obviously started years before I bought my house. We got in at a time where we were just looking for some place we could afford, and we got lucky. But it was interesting to see the scaffolds go up and to see who was responsible for all of this happening. And I had read about gentrification, but I never really got to witness it firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being 15 years old. My grandmother lived by Memorial Stadium. And I remember our experience, a wonderful experience having a stadium in the community in which she lived.
Yep.
Middle class, black community for the most part, from what I knew as a child. But I remember being 15 years old wondering, why would they move the stadium downtown? What's taking place here? I wouldn't find out later, you know, what that change was. And, I mean, I'm no political scientist. You know, I don't have, you know, I'm no economist, you know, but that was a question that I had. You know, why would they move the stadium downtown? Why is everything being focused, pushing everything towards the water? You know, why is everybody flipping these properties and these taxes are going sky high? And I knew that the people who originally lived in these communities wouldn't be able to afford these taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So I started investigating on my own, and I started investigating a term called, you know, economic eviction. And that's when it got interesting to me. I don't want to monopolize the radio.
So yeah, we'll work our way back down to that. But yeah. I think that one of the interesting things about this particular block they picked out, that A, it felt kind of almost hard for people to find a block or a neighborhood in Baltimore that is really interracial. I mean, this neighborhood you grew up in, Adam, is not interracial by design.
I didn't talk to Joan much about how the choice was made on the block and was interested in that, but... yeah, I mean, I guess there's a certain amount of dead luck that followed behind, you know, whether that was a random choice or how long they had to search to find a block that fit their mold.
Ed. I don't know. If
yeah, I think I know how they picked the block, actually, because they called and asked. I know all the blocks around Patterson Park, and I think there are any number of blocks. I mean, the neighborhood is, I think, now racially integrated. So I just gave them some blocks where I knew people. I knew Shanaysia, Okay. I know people in the other blocks. I told them, they talked to everybody and decided for whatever reason that your block was a good fit for what they were looking for. But any number of blocks north of Patterson Park, I think, are well integrated.
Mm-hmm. How many people here grew up in neighborhoods that, and I'm going to go to get a phone call in here because a woman's calling in from on the road, when to get Carrie on the phone here. But how many of you grew up in neighborhoods that were mixed?
I suppose, it's predominantly white. I don't know if that, and I was one of maybe two or three black families in the neighborhood, if that counts.
And where is that? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Norfolk, Virginia. That was an all-black community. I grew up in St. Mary's County, Maryland, about an hour south of D.C.
Oh, yeah.
So if that qualifies, and I certainly.
That's interesting. You grew up in St. Mary's County.
I did.
I have a different story. I grew up two blocks from where Ed grew up, but I grew up in the early 50s. And so when blacks started moving into that neighborhood with block busting and everything else that was going on, all the whites left.
Oh, yeah.
I was, and it's only, 30 years later that I could see what happened and how it happened. So we moved to Highlandtown. I grew up after that in an entirely white neighborhood.
Adam, you grew up in a mix of places.
Yeah, the majority of which I would say were definitely majorly white. I was usually even though I'm mixed, usually the standout in the kind of occasionally small communities I was a part of, usually university towns. And of course that served in a way to be a little bit of a buffer to my arrival into the part of Baltimore that we moved into when we first got here, because it was maybe only a couple of blocks south of the kind of then determined north-south divisionary line between what at the time was the white working class section of East Baltimore.
Right.
Which is, at that time, I refer to it all as Highlandtown, even though it's all been so eviscerated. It is, if it was like east of Broadway and west of Greektown, it was all Highlandtown when I got here. But where we lived, I was, again, as I say, maybe two blocks south in the neighborhood where it pretty much blatantly became all white. And had it not been for my years growing up in different white communities around the country, I probably would not have had the savvy to have, made it at that time, or at least, had much positive communication with the kids in the neighborhood.
We're talking with four people who were part of an article in the Urbanite magazine about the 3,000 block of East Baltimore Street, which is an interracial neighborhood. We're going to talk about what that means. Is it important to have an interracial neighborhood? Is it important to cross racial lines in the way we live, the way we often where we work is mixed, but that seems to be the extent of where it is. Is it important? What is life like that really like? And we're going to delve into their lives a bit more on this block and what they think about the future. What do you think? And what do you think about where you live, where you grew up? 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Carrie, on the road, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Carrie.
I'm so thrilled to be on. I've been listening for years, and I have never been able to stay on the line long enough.
Well, good. I'm glad you stayed this time. Welcome.
So hello to you and to your guests. I wanted to just tell you, I just tuned in, and I hope my comment is relevant. But what happened was, when my family moved here, it was 1966, and my parents chose a neighborhood based upon where Dad was working, which happened to be on the west side of town. So we were not there when there was anything like block busting. I don't have that experience. But I do know that I was really small, so we moved into a neighborhood where, from the beginning, the kids around me were different colors and different religions. And then when I went to school, we were all there in the classroom together. And I was just this tiny kid and didn't know any different, but it was a wonderful experience. And the neighborhood didn't stay as nice. People with more money moved away, and the school in the neighborhood became less pleasant. And it left me with a lingering question about, do integrated neighborhoods, can they survive? Can they persist, or is it really a neighborhood in transition? Mm-hmm. And it was always a big disappointment to me that it didn't remain the way it was.
You raise a very important question, and really, I think, this assumptive question about interracial neighborhoods. I mean, there are a few neighborhoods in town. I lived for 25 years or so in Windsor Hills, which was a neighborhood that was consciously interracial. People fought to keep it mixed from the time that the majority Jewish population started moving out. Some Jewish families stayed. Gay couples moved in. African-American families were moving into the neighborhood, which is why some families moved out. But then a lot of other mixed families moved in and became – people worked hard to keep it that way. But that, to me, seems to be an anomaly.
Can I add something? Am I still on?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. My comment on to what you said is the strange thing is I don't live on the west side of town now, but I have several friends who live in Windsor Hills now and who've lived there for a long time and love it. And I was wondering, because I heard one of them refer in passing once to some kind of national organization of integrated neighborhoods that is, like you said, purposefully so and intends to remain so. And I Googled such a thing but couldn't find it.
The neighborhoods, in Baltimore, it's called Baltimore Neighborhoods Incorporated, BNI. And it's where they, that's what the organization is for. It's part of a whole national movement, like Hyde Park in Chicago and other neighborhoods where they're trying to keep things mixed, though they're upscale. What were you going to say, Shoshana?
I was going to say that when my observations moving into, I guess, what is now Patterson Park, which is probably really Highland Town, was that the neighborhood was racially mixed. It was, but I think when we moved in 2002, it was essentially poor black and poor white. Mm-hmm. I think now we have probably a mixture of socioeconomic statuses as well as a racial diversity operating in Patterson Park for probably reasons that Ed could speak to more than I. But at least from my observation, I noticed, you know, the prostitutes on the corner who generally were white, who always spoke and greeted my young children when I was coming home from the hospital. And, you know, that was at least my impression of the neighborhood. I sort of got the sense of poor black, poor white living together in a community that certainly started to change within years of our moving there. So
is it still economically mixed?
I think our block is. I think in general, I think the community is.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there's been a huge influx of people that work at Hopkins. You know, I would say living within that, if not on our block. I'm not using our block as that example, but not.
At least one, actually, is true.
Yeah, okay. And then so, you know, three and four blocks, especially as Ed said, like up the hill and headed in a westerly direction. And then, you know, the ends of our block are both, you know, taquerias now owned, I'm certain, by, you know, Latino families that can't live very far away, if not there on the block also. So, you know, yeah, I would say that the economic ladder is definitely a part of that structure. And then whether or not that plays into how much of a transient build that becomes, if the mixed nature of the neighborhood based on the economic status of people, you got people who are obviously like buying into the neighborhood. They have jobs at Hopkins. They're planning to own houses. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got families full of renters who are in a situation of a waiting game as to see how, I would imagine, that plays out with regard to does the neighborhood continue to pan out to be someplace where either, A, they can afford, most importantly, I'm sure, to own homes, or does it, because of the mixed nature of the status, begin to be out of reach for people at the lower rung of that ladder?
Edward?
I would agree with Adam. I would like to believe that my block is like unique and everybody chose to live there because we want to live amongst a diverse, you know, community. But I strictly see our block as being diverse economically, racially, because we are the border of what you can afford and what you can't afford. Anybody on our block who didn't live on our block already, if they could afford to live in Canton or up the hill, they probably would.
Up the hill, meaning west.
West up the hill.
Up Baltimore Street.
Up Baltimore Street.
Just past
Patterson Park.
Right.
And we are the border from north to south. Mm-hmm. That's the border between north and south. And if you stand on our block and look that away, you'll see young white families going into their homes, getting into their economic, you know, cars, you know, the hybrids. But if you look the other way, it's a whole different demographic, you know, and that's unique in itself. But, I mean, I think if you take any community in America in which that real estate game has been played, you'll find that same block. You'll find the family who moved in by accident in 2002. You'll find the guy who's been there since the beginning of time, meaning Adam. You know, you'll find the house that was bought by someone who lived in D.C. because they couldn't afford living in D.C., so they bought it in Baltimore, and now they're trying to rent it out to someone. And the person who rents it is someone who can't afford to live in Canton, and they want to live close to O'Donnell Square or Canton or Fells Point.
So, I mean, Ed, I'm going to go back to the phones here, but Ed, do you see Patterson Park and the neighborhood? It'll be called Patterson Park now because neighborhood names have changed. It's like the Federal Hill was never called Federal Hill. It was always South Baltimore. They became Federal Hill when they wanted to make money on it. Because I organized tenants on Federal Hill for rent strikes when it was South Baltimore. So do you see the east side of our town around Patterson Park staying interracial? I mean, you have a hard time in the school that you run getting any white students to get there. Maybe you have 10%. So, I mean, do you see the future of that neighborhood being mixed, or do you see it being upscale and white and poor blacks and Latinos of different varieties being pushed further east and out?
It's impossible to predict. And I never exactly knew what we were after except to create a good neighborhood, and who would move in without regard to color. We wound up selling, of course, very expensive houses. But we rented houses. I mean, part of that vision was to always be able to do affordable rentals at the same time we were selling higher priced houses. We were converting our rentals into more modestly priced houses. So there was some consciousness to it, but not any real sense of where it would end. I think there's now, for instance, with the school, a real effort to provide a viable educational alternative for whoever's in the neighborhood, whether it's the whole economic spectrum, that they don't have to leave, that the quality of education is such they don't have to leave, whatever color they are. Certainly we're attracting more white families now, but it's still a fraction, still a sizable Latino population. And I've always thought that the more people of different types that you could attract, I mean, nobody's ever going to move to Patterson Park because they think it's really upscale. I don't know that it will ever be Canton.
I don't see that.
It's just not built the same way.
Yeah,
or it'll never be Federal Hill. But because of the park, where you'll have Latino volleyball games on Sundays that attract hundreds of people, the soccer games, the swimming pool, the ice rink, the park becomes a center for all kinds of people.
Yeah, that has hugely changed,
right.
and so much for the better, because there was just years where it was a ghost town.
Right.
Nothing went
people
on in the
park. People wouldn't go in the park.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I know people who bought their houses in the late 90s and would not go for fear of their safety.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to say something else about sort of how the park anchors all of these neighborhoods in southeast Baltimore. I mean, I think that, you know, what my husband, Ed, suggests is probably correct. I mean, I think there is sort of an anthropology that sort of emerges around that neighborhood. Now, I'm not sure if it's by design or if it's more so just a set of circumstance. I mean, the park is a huge draw in terms of those who have the means. They're wanting to have easy access to the park. If you go sort of further east of the park and north of the park, I mean, there are communities that are fairly well anchored there that are sort of different socioeconomically and racially from those who are sort of moving in to the neighborhood. And maybe that doesn't matter. I'm not really one for changing people's preferences, right? People believe what they believe. They choose to live where they choose to live. You know, some people won't move north of Baltimore Street, much less Eastern Avenue. Other people won't, you know, move east of, you know, the 2800 block. But what's important about the park is that the park provides an opportunity for different users of the park to converge in one place and to figure out how they're going to share that space, whether that is taking your children to the park or
right.
children who go
right.
there unaccustomed with adults, or if you're walking your dog, or if you're playing Sunday volleyball or playing football, or you're playing kickball. I mean, I think the park just represents this huge opportunity for these different communities who may decide to live in different sections of the park for whatever reason to come in and share the use of the space. And it is an absolutely great space for those communities.
Let me open the phones here again. We'll come right back to all of us. No, it's fine. I think that that's interesting that the park is an anchor forcing communities across age, class, race to share a space. It's also a rarity in this city. It doesn't happen in Druid Hill Park. It doesn't happen in a lot of other parks. Never happened in Patterson Park before, but it's happening in Patterson Park now. Back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Martha, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Martha.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. What I wanted to know, I grew up in upstate New York. I've always been the one because we lived in very integrated communities. And now I've moved to Maryland. I've moved to Windsor Mills. And I chose specifically to live there. I'm black, and I wanted to, for the first time in my life, live in a majority black community.
Mm-hmm.
And also to have integrated community, too. And I'm very happy. It's the best decision I ever made in my life. But before I came here, I purchased a house in upstate New York, 20 houses on the block. We were the first blacks to move in to the neighborhood. It was like the prime neighborhood in the community. And the day we moved in, the next day, signs went up all along the block for sale signs. And I remember saying to my next-door neighbor, I said, well, I certainly hope these people aren't moving out because they're black. And she says, oh, no, they're older people. They were going to move. And I said, oh, okay. I said, but I happen to be, and this is true, the HUD Fair Housing Administrator for upstate New York. I said, so I'm going to file a complaint just in case. And the next day, all the signs in the neighborhood went down. And suddenly, I lived there for 9 years before I moved to Maryland. Only one house sold on the block in those 9 years. And I would like to know, anthropologically, why do whites behave in this manner? Is it fear? What is it that causes them to not acknowledge that people are going to possibly or even give the benefit of the doubt that people might be good neighbors, but instead to just start running and fight flight? What is it that creates that fear?
That's a really good question. We've done whole shows on that. But Adam?
In the amount of time that I have lived in Highland Town, that's one of the things that I had to deal with experiencing firsthand, and the effects of which the roller coaster ride that actually put the neighborhood through from the time that I moved there got to 3011, which is the house number I'm at. And when I first was on that block, when I first played in the park with the handful of newfound friends that I made, the likes of which were two or three, Italian bloodline, actually two really good friends of mine who were Korean. Their mother and father owned a little corner bodega. Most of us, had similar likes and dislikes that young kids would have. And the one thing that we had to discuss a lot were the things that were handed down by a lot of my friends' parents about either myself or our two Korean friends, and how there was a distinct welcomeness or not. There were friends of mine houses I was not allowed in, that we literally were asked to wait out front when it was we were just stopping by on our bikes to grab a drink of water or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what happened in the early to late 80s with regard to the changes in my neighborhood that affected literally the families of these kids that I knew really well had to do with this fear, had to do with a lot of the changes of what happened with the insurgence of hardcore street drugs during the 80s in the inner city. For the first time, a generation of kids who had been, for the most part, kind of in an untouchable zone were experiencing the kind of distraught addiction that was only rumored or heard about from up the hill that happened to the black kids, that happened in a black society.
We're going to be a really short break and come right back. And but I want to kind of also wrestle more with Martha's question about why the was it seen that when black folks move in, white folks run away. And that is true. And I wonder if it's going to change generationally. Will that change? We'll talk about that bit, Martha, and go to Douglas to your call as well. 410-319-8888. We'll be back in just a minute to continue our conversation with Edward and Shanacious Halls, Adam Stab, Edward Kowski. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. In this month's issue, four teams of collaborators explore four very different visions of the city. It's the Urbanite Project, a special annual issue devoted to the showcasing outside-the-box thinking from Baltimore's most creative minds. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbaniteBaltimore.com. For a list of drop locations, we'll come back, wrestle some more with Martha's question, and hear from Douglas in Baltimore. Next caller up. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We're having another one of our Urbanite radio stories today. This is a conversation from an article by Joan Jacobson in the February issue about the 3,000 block of East Baltimore Street, which was a interracial block. They featured people like Shanacia and Edward Sauls, who are here, who raised their three children on that block. They bought a home there in 2002. His mother thought he was out of his mind buying what seemed to be a house in a white neighborhood of Highlandtown, and would they survive there alive? They did. Adam Stab is with us, who grew up there, and he grew up there as a teenager, experienced that world in a very different way because he's biracial and experienced that and lives back there in the house you grew up in now. He's an artist, and Edward Kowski is with us. He's co-founder of the Patterson Park Community Development Corporation and executive director of the Patterson Park Public Charter School. Number is 410-319-8888. Before we go to Douglas, our next caller, wrestle a bit with this white flight issue and why it happens. I mean, it happens. The question, I'd be very curious to see how much it happens now. My guess would be it still happens in great waves, maybe not as much as when you and I were younger, Ed, and both our neighborhoods were full of white flight and people fleeing because you make the excuse of property values going down because black folks are moving in, or people but sometimes the clear subtext was, we just don't want to live next door to black people. They're too different than we are. We need to live someplace else.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want to discount racial intolerance or however you described the last thing, but I do think, and this is one of the principles we used with the CDC, that at the core of it, there is the fear of loss, significant loss of property value, which, I mean, happens. It happens for deliberate reasons, not just that people are leaving, but also because slumlords and, you know, irresponsible absentee investors come in and buy up the properties. That's a big piece of it. And I think what, for instance, the CDC set out to prove, and we actually had a program with the Able Foundation, we guaranteed anybody who would stay in the neighborhood that they would not lose value if they stayed for 5 years and the value went down. The Able Foundation would make up whatever they would have lost. And what we found out was a lot of people stayed just because of the guarantee. They didn't take advantage of it or anything, but that fear of loss of property value is very real. And the other thing we did, of course, was outbid all the investors. We bought all the properties so that they couldn't go to slumlords. And in that way, I think we maintain the integrity and the stability of the neighborhood. And that is to say, just to answer the question, it is, I think, a very real fear of loss of property value. I think if it weren't for that, people would be willing to stay to see if it would work. Not everybody, because there's a level of racial intolerance you can't do anything about. But a lot more people would stay if they knew their property values. And now that's why the neighborhood's stable, yeah, I think. I nobody's trying to leave because nobody's afraid of values going down.
Right. It's no longer an example of a neighborhood where that sort of thing is possible. You know, I mean, that happened. That happened largely while my parents were there, that it hit its lowest point. While they still owned the house, there were times that it had gotten to a point where there had been so much white flight and nothing had bounced back. The Canton wave had not come that far north, where there was, you know, was, and I'm sure this was before you guys were on the block, where I was worried about them coming home at night. Corner boys are starting to be around, you know.
Well, I was worried, I think, up until about maybe 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was worried. I was actually more concerned about my husband. We've had this conversation several times. For some reason, I felt safe as a young mother with a lot of kids. Just got the sense that no one would bother me. But I was often worried about my husband being walking the block at night. So, sorry for interrupting.
I don't mean to take it into a different direction,
but
I think, yeah, but thank you, Mark. I think white flight goes way deeper than property values or anything of that nature. I believe it stems, you know, from, I'm going to simplify it. The biggest fear of any white male is that his daughter comes home with an African-American male. And the way that we, I'm talking about in the 1940s, 50s, so have you, the way you prevent that, the best way you know how, is to get away from them, all right? And when I say that, that white woman dating that black male represents a lot. It represents what that first Portuguese pirate who sold slaves, what he saw when he saw the slave and what he feared when he saw the muscles. And white supremacy exists, and it creates a lot of things that we still deal with today. You know, I know that's not the topic, but when you talk about white people not wanting to live next door to black people, that's what it is. It's the fear that the media has constantly perpetuated. I deal with it. I listen to people say, well, when I have to go down there to pick up my stepson because he lives off of East whatever, I'm like, what's down there? And who are those people that you're referring to? I do not like it when people speak bad about the city, bad about city schools. My children attend city schools. I live in the city. I'm from the city. Urban does not equal bad.
You know, EJ, it's funny that you bring up those points. There's several things that were triggered. I think one has to do with Mark's question about whether or not this new generation of residents will sort of bear out this cycle of white flight. Mm-hmm. Right? But here's what's happening with this new generation. We're a part of a generation who wants to live in the city, right? Now, there's a lot of potential in the fact that this new generation of, you know, young, white, black, Latino, Asian wants to live in the city, that they're going to have to figure out a way to live in a city where their forebears, their parents, their grandparents did not want to live in those spaces, right? And so there's still residual effects of that. Now, what's complicated, and I think this sort of speaks to the issues that EJ raises, is, again, if you take an area like Patterson Park, how you make your choices about, I mean, people make choices about which blocks they want to live on, you know, for certain reasons, or what times they will take their children to the park, or what time they will go to the park, or, you know, all kinds of things, sort of calculations that aren't, may not qualify as white flight in the traditional or conventional way that we would understand it. But in many ways, I think that there's certainly sort of this negotiating of the space so that the fear is alleviated. So, for example, someone may make the decision to move to, say, just west of Patterson Park versus just east of Patterson Park. And, you know, sure, the houses may be nicer, maybe not. I mean, I suppose you can make that argument. They may represent a more investment of time and care and so on and so forth. But I think there is something to be said that there is this sort of deliberate decision, despite the fact that there's an acceptance of wanting to live in the city, that there are certain spaces that are more protected or insulated from those fears, white fears, however you want to express them, than other spaces would be.
I'm going to explore a bit more what you just said here about these spaces. I think that's a very critical issue. 410-319-8888. You've heard this discussion on the air. I'd like to hear your thoughts. Douglas in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Mark Steiner, beautiful show. I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you.
From the top, I listen most of the time when I can. a caller from upstate New York. I'm from that area. Look, white flight, I mean, it's alive and well, taking different forms here in Baltimore. But let me say this. The media controls all of these images that people see about any type of mixed race or any type of community or organization. Once the media casted an image, people use that image to make decisions about where they live, where they want to go to school, or whether or not they want to be around any kind of racially motivated situation. They make decisions based on what they see on media. And until we can control the media, we can't control these images that people have of us. I mean, upstate New York, now, that's a whole different program up there. The way they move when we, quote-unquote, come around, it's just crazy insane. If you took the time to know your neighbor, you wouldn't have to run from them. And I blame some of the images on television, radio. It's always the negative image that one can get of any kind of racial group. Nothing positive, especially when it comes to minorities. Black and brown were the first ones at the top of the news, and all these pictures and images. And just like the caller said before, nobody wants to be around, quote-unquote, those type of people, period. And that's my comment.
Thanks so much. I mean, I think that our perceptions are, in many ways, kind of seen through the filter of the media. I mean, we see what's happening right now in the city, which we're going to talk about on Thursday, which there's closing of clubs that in town. People want to close clubs, and the clubs that are visited mostly by young black kids who are from the hip-hop generation. Those are the clubs they want to close. But the same clubs, other clubs where they're mostly white in the city, where the kids aren't, in Fells Point, South Baltimore, where people, you know, urinate on people's steps and get loud and crazy, nobody's talking about closing those clubs. So that's a conversation to be had about that, about our images and what we expect and who the city is for. So join us Thursday for that conversation. We're going to do that. Let me get another caller in here, and then I'm going to come right back, because I really want to ask Shanesha to talk more about the times people pick to go to the park. I found that interesting. Let me go to Len in Baltimore. You're on the air. Len, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi.
I just wanted to add, you know, contribute to the discussion, because I don't think anyone can deny or should deny the influence of race in decisions about where people live, and particularly whites who left the city. But I live in an area in Baltimore County where there are a lot of whites who left the city, and the area has become more and more multinational with different nationalities, both African-Americans, Africans, Asians. And folks are staying largely because the property values have either stayed the same or actually gone up. So I don't think we can certainly deny the influence of racism. At the same time, I think that's a powerful indication of financial self-interest in terms of where people live.
You mind me asking what neighborhood it is you're talking about?
It's in Baltimore County. Eastern Baltimore County, toward White Marsh,
okay.
In that area there.
So let me ask you this question. I'm just curious, since you live out there in that neighborhood. One of the things I said in the show just a little bit ago was this: some of the most interracial neighborhoods I found in Baltimore are on the east side of Baltimore County, whether you're talking about Cockeysville and Towson, all the way around to where you live in White Marsh.
Right.
And it was really, I would go to visit and do some things there. I was really shocked to see, you know, Latinos, Arab Americans, Indian Americans, Black Americans, white folks, old and young, living in these neighborhoods. How the neighbors interact with one another, I'm always curious.
You know, it's mixed. These houses are, you know, four bedrooms, fairly large. It's not a row house neighborhood like a
right.
lot of us once lived in. But, generally, people and everybody, you know, I'm older than most of my neighbors, but the neighbors are generally always over each other's houses. They're watching each other's kids. It's much different than the experience that a lot of us left in the city. But I, you know, I, like I said, I think it's an indication of financial self-interest, and not to deny racism, but you know, the property values question is a very, very real one.
Len, thanks so much. I wonder very quickly, the people on the panel, before we go back to our next caller, who's Kim, whether you see your future as living in neighborhoods like you're living in now that are mixed, whether that's even important.
It's a good question, Mark.
It is a good question.
I live in my house because I didn't want it to not be in my family, so I'm keeping it. It's going to be
you're
passed
there.
Down. And I, again, I don't see that neighborhood being able to go through any similar such changes. It's already gone through. It is in transition, but the transition is definitely, I think, a progressive one. I think it's on some sort of a pace toward a march forward. As Ed said, it's in a strange little place where there's you can look one way and you can see mass amounts of progress and development, and then you can look another direction and it poses a big question mark. But in that way, I think it's stabilized in an integrated direction, and I don't see it sliding back really.
And I guess the question I was also posing along with that was, it, I mean, do you find that important? Is that important in your lives, or is it really just happenstance? And you could just as easily live in an all African American neighborhood, and it would be no different.
I've always kind of had the personal theory that too much of anything is bad. I like diversity. I grew up in diverse communities. I wrestled in high school. I wrestled in college. A lot of times I was the only black on the team or, you know. But when I went home, I still had my black friends. You know, I had Jewish friends. I mean, I really, really enjoyed experience. I've been to numerous bar mitzvahs. And, you know, if I would have stayed in East Baltimore, then I would never experience that. But to answer your question, it's very important. I think no matter where I live, I'll always own my house on East Baltimore Street if I can, because we actually talked about if we leave, coming back to that house. I said, I don't want to be like the people that I talk about. I always scrutinize the African-American families who had houses in Baltimore.
Yeah, we're actually more critical of African-American families than we are probably any other demographic.
What do you mean by that, Shanae?
You want me?
Sure.
Okay.
Since I interrupted.
Shanae, excuse me.
Well, I believe in the 80s, when black families so-called made it, they said, okay, what do we do now? Where did the white people do? That's where we're going. We moved out to Sedonia. Okay?
Where's Sedonia? I'm sorry, I haven't.
Sorry. East Side.
Okay,
yeah,
East Side.
East Side.
So that's still in the city.
In the 90s, when you so-called made it as a black family, you went to college, you came back, you got married, whatever, so have you. You've reached, you know, your pinnacle of life. You moved to Randallstown, then Woodlawn, then Owings Mills. But the further out that blacks move, whites move even further. So while we talked about white flight, I'm more critical of black flight, is because why is it that it seems that African Americans follow the trends of white Americans, but
it's that same insipid media.
Right.
That's all we know.
Shanisha?
Yeah. There's only one up. There's only one up. You know what I mean? That all has to be redefined. You know, here.
Right.
It's not up.
Shanisha?
Yeah, I think that one of the, I think we've earned the reputation of being an urban snob among our friends. Many people in our cohort are sort of, you know, middle class African Americans.
You mean your African American cohort?
Right. Do not live in the city. And, you know, we find it humorous that our white cohort, members of our white cohort or white middle class, will move to the city first. And the African-American cohort will not. Some of them have roots in Baltimore City, as a matter of fact. And they seem to only consider it once it has the sort of the stamp of approval.
Well, I think it's like that one caller said on how insipid the media I mean, it's what you're talking about is the direct mirror of the fact that the urban reality is now being resold. It's being rethought. It's being turned green, you know, and it's safer and it's user friendly. It's not like it was anymore. So, you know, that's what the media is selling. So that's what people are buying.
Let me get, because callers are calling in to kind of comment on what you all created here. Let me get their thoughts. Come right back to our panel. 410-319-8888. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi, Kim. Mark. I want to thank you for having this show. I'm so glad, in a way, I'm kind of glad that we're still talking about race. But I wish that we would all get to a point where we appreciate and value each other's races. And I mean, we're different. But just because we're different shouldn't mean that we can't get along. I almost feel like we're back with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. I've never heard race discussed as much in my life. And I think we as adults and we as parents, we need to integrate our children and have our children be a little bit more diverse. Have them around Caucasian Latinos and, you know, people who don't necessarily look like us. Because another thing that I haven't heard anybody talk about is white in flight. Because you have a lot of Caucasians now coming back into the city, but the property values where they live are so high where most African-Americans can't even afford to live, like Canton, some parts of East Baltimore around the Johns Hopkins area. So, I mean, we got to really just, I wish that we could get to a point where we just be considerate and value each other's ethnic backgrounds, period.
Kim, thank you for those thoughts. You going to say something? Again,
just, well, what comes to mind right away, that's exactly what we're talking about. We've got a block. And really, the most of the neighborhood around that block, that is that kind of place. It's an amazing neighborhood. We think it's stable. And for me, it's always been something that we could point at and say, is this what you're talking about? It sure looks like what you're talking about. You know, Shanaysia's kids and, you know, white families' kids are going to grow up in this place playing together without the same kind of thing that, you know, my mother and Ed's mother felt whenever a white kid or a black kid showed up at the house. Yeah. That's what this show's about, I think. I think we're pointing the way.
When you look, again, like we mentioned briefly about the use of Patterson Park and just the rampant use of the park from day to evening, that is a shining example of where I think it can go. Because
I was going to say, my children don't have any of the baggage that adults have, right? I mean, they have – And I don't think I'm not just talking glowingly about my kids because they're mine, even though I could. But that's not really the point.
Your mother, of course you will.
I mean, I think that their perspective is one such that they play with our Dominican neighbors next door. And they have friends who are of all races and different economic, socioeconomic statuses, because that actually matters. I mean, that intersection is so key to a lot of the issues that we brought up. So I think that Ed has every reason to be hopeful and to say that, you know, there's a lot of progress. You know, but... And I have to say the but, you know, as an African-American woman, you know, the day has not happened yet. Well, I can go through an entire day, 2 days, 3 days, 1 week without being aware that I'm an African-American woman. And if I can just share a story really briefly, I attended my first PPNA meeting, Patterson Park Neighborhood Association meeting, back in 2002. And I had my daughter with me and I was greeted by one of the members there. And, you know, we were chatting. And throughout the course of the conversation, she asked me, she asked me if I was a homeowner. I said, yeah. She's like, oh. She's like, did you purchase an FHA loan? And I said, no. It was a conventional loan. Why? And she was like, oh, and good. And then she just started talking about something else. And I still tell that story to this day. It was a good experience, 95%. But that 5%, the question she was asking me was whether or not I was, you know, poor, black.
I'm going to get this call in here from Owings Mills. I think I want to respond to you very quickly before we run out of time. But that's what Lester Spencer's talking about, which is why he lives in an all-black neighborhood. When he was on an Urbanite show, saying because he needs to be in a space where he doesn't have to always be black. 410-319-8888. Ben, you're on the air. Ben, you there?
Good show.
Thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to say this real quick. I disagree with a statement I heard of one of the brothers say about him taking issue with people leaving the communities and moving out. I grew up in a place called the Station, and where I grew up at, it was a great place, and I had a great upbringing. But the fact of the matter is, the houses there, number one, they're very small. They have no basements, and they have closets about as wide as my arm space. So, I mean, as far as me, yeah, okay, I've been blessed enough to have a decent job where I can go and give my kids something I never had, a basement, a yard to play in. You understand what I'm saying? You know, a peaceful surrounding. With, you know, so I don't see what's wrong with a black person who decides they want to have a little space and a little, you know, and try to give their child a little bit of a different environment than they had. I don't see how that's selling out or whatever it is. That I don't see myself thinking I'm better than anybody because I moved locations, because where I live is predominantly black.
Well, Ben, let me just, we only have like less than a minute left, so I'm gonna let Ed kind of give a very, very quick response, if you'd like to.
Well, number one, nobody used the word selling out or anything to judge anyone, so that's an induced feeling. But what I would say is that there are plenty of white families, Latino families, who enjoy the city, and they live in the same houses that people lived in the 20s, and they're raising their families and having a great time, and they're advocating for their communities and their schools,
and
so they don't have
schools.
To move to get that. They create it where they live.
Let's talk. But that'd be an interesting conversation, Ben, I think, for us to have in the air about why people want to live in the suburbs. And people do, obviously. We wouldn't have them, would we? So we'll talk
They're
about that.
They're getting more and more like the city every day.
Yeah. Let me thank Edward and Shanaisha Sauls, Adam Stabb, Edward Kelsey for being on the show today, and for one of our Urbanite Radio Conversations for Urbanite Magazine, putting the story out that got us started here today. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to remind you that Tuesday, March 23rd, from 5:30 p.m., come to the Women's Industrial Exchange, where they're going to honor the Industrious Woman of the Year Award to Dr. Carol Greider, who won the Nobel Prize, and she lives here in Baltimore. You can call 410-685-4388 or go to wiedirector@gmail.com for more ticket information. We'll tell you more about that another day. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by David Kirby, author of Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment. Stay with us. We'll be right back.